serious attempts to define two worldviews. And the two are that the world came into existence by the forces of pure chance. And from an initial chance happening, all things which are observable in the universe have happened. And that is called the theory and is adopted by the vast majority of people. So let's just have a look at this worldview, because it is this worldview that we really have to contend with. The other, the view that Marx proclaimed and the view of Freud and some of these other men are really sort of subsidiary views within a greater worldview, which is the theory of evolution. And this theory is all permeating into our whole economy of economics, of social science, of general science, of biology, of microbiology, and of physics and chemistry, is all viewed through the binoculars of this worldview. If you send your kid to college, he won't be taught anything but this worldview. And he gets it in public school beginning at grade one. So when brethren come along and say to me, well, I don't think the theory of evolution is serious, you know, our kids go to Sunday school. Yeah, they go to Sunday school from about quarter after 10 to 20 to 11. And if you think that 20 minutes of Sunday school over the period of time from age 5 to 15 is going to convince them that the theory of evolution is wrong, when the whole concept they get in their education system is devoted to a promotion of this worldview, I got news for you. It isn't going to do. So that's why I tell our young people and the people who run our young people's programs that every student should have at least a working knowledge of what's wrong with the theory of evolution. If we're talking about a worldview and there's only two, for goodness sakes, we should have our young people and ourselves acquainted at least with what the other worldview is and what's wrong with it. Because if we don't have the mental equipment to grapple with that situation, then we're going to go down to defeat. And I've never been of the opinion that the defense of our worldview, which is the biblical worldview, should be left to other people. I think we should be foremost and forward in being able to defend our position with the worldview that we hold. So let's for a minute have a look at the other worldview, and that is this: the theory of evolution. That evolution entails a self-contained universe. In other words, everything that's in the whole universe around us is self-contained, and it's there. That's the total of all there is. In which it's innate laws. In other words, there's something within this universe that we find out there, something intrinsically within it, innate, which develop everything into higher levels of organization. In other words, there's something we don't know about, but within that universe, which we find out there, built into it, intrinsically within it, there are laws which push the system to higher forms of organization. Particles evolve into elements. In other words, you have a particle of hydrogen. Somehow or other, it evolves into gold, which is a much more complex molecule than the hydrogen molecule. And elements evolve into complex chemicals. For instance, methane or protein is a much higher organized situation than just a bare molecule. Complex chemicals, on the other hand, evolve into simple living systems. And simple life forms evolve into complex life forms. And finally, you get up to man. Now this is the worldview that is universally accepted in all universities, all high schools, all public schools, most theological schools. I mean, this is the worldview that is held. And when we come to have a look at it, we find that on page 2 of our little outline here, we deal with this theory of evolution, and they have to start somewhere. In other words, you have to have an origin. When you see, say, man, you have to say, well, how did man get here? You have to go back in time and find an origin. So what they have developed is what is called the Big Bang Theory. And the Big Bang Theory, in essence, is that about 5 billion years ago, all matter in the universe was compressed into a very, very tight mass. Tremendously compressed, which of course had within it tremendous energy. And for some unknown reason, this tight mass of hydrogen blew apart and is still blowing apart. And out of that formed all the planets and stars and solar system out there. And astronomers tell us that it's still an expanding universe. And the reason they call it an expanding universe is because the tremendous force which was in this original tightly compact situation, which exploded apart, and the stuff is still going outwards from that center. Now, from the gases and so on, which were created from this thing, all the planets, the stars, the comets, this planet Earth, have come. The gas condensed when it got out there, and the stars were formed, and the planets were formed, and one of the planets was this planet Earth. So that's the worldview. Now, the essence of that worldview is that it excludes God or anything, any supernatural element from the worldview. So if you hold the theory of evolution, then you exclude any intelligence or any other factor entering into the system from your viewpoint. So they come now to the planet Earth, and they say from this original Big Bang theory, which is pretty well universally accepted, planet Earth was formed. It's one of the planets that are circling around the sun. Just so happens they circle around the sun in the most precise mathematical order that you could possibly imagine. But this, of course, all happened by chance. So now we get down to planet Earth. Planet Earth, of course, was originally hot, according to the worldview that evolution puts forward. And it cooled down. And as it cooled down, somehow or other, the first original form of life came to this planet. And from that first original form of life, which was formed by chance, all living things, both of animal and floral nature, have come, including man. So here we are. We're the result of this worldview that, with the cooling down of the Earth, life came to this planet in the form of a simple cell. And from that simple cell, all things have evolved, including man. So God, of course, and anything supernatural, is left out of this worldview. Now remember, brothers and sisters, that your children and grandchildren are being dinged in with this thing day and night. All the sciences, no matter whether they study social science, or physical science, or mathematical science, or whatever it is, all have as its base the theory of evolution. And if you don't believe it, and if you don't accept it, you are considered to be a freak of nature, and completely out of it, not with it, and so forth, and a religious bigot that really doesn't know what time it is. Now this is the milieu in which our children are growing up. So if we aren't able to cope with an explanation of our worldview and a condemnation of that worldview, we lose by default. And I for one am not prepared to lose by default, because I feel that it's very important for all of us to be able to at least have a working knowledge. I'm not saying we have to have a PhD from Harvard University in microbiology, But at least we should have a working knowledge of what's wrong with the other theory. Now, the other theory says that as this planet cooled down, life, a living organism, came to this planet. Now the creationist said, fine, that's what happened, eh? Yep. Well, if that's what happened by the forces of pure chance 4.5 billion years ago, why can't you do it in the lab today? You know the elements that make up living things, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, all these elements. You have a lab, you have intelligence. So if chance was able to do this remarkable thing 4.5 billion years ago with no intelligence, surely now that you guys who have PhDs and MAs and all these fancy degrees, surely to goodness, you should be able to duplicate in the modern laboratory what pure chance did 4.5 billion years ago. Is that a fair challenge? Would you think? Well, of course it is. It's a very fair challenge. For goodness sakes, if pure chance did it in the past, surely to goodness, with our modern knowledge, we should be able to do it with impunity at the drop of a hat right now. So creationists have issued this challenge to evolutionists. And the first challenge of a serious nature, I guess it was issued on this point, was about 1930. Well, the evolutionists were kind of pricked with that one, because that's a very cogent challenge. Well, there's one country in the world that has atheism, and of course atheism and this worldview run hand in hand, as its creed, and that's Russia. And they knew that they were sort of on the spot, you might say, to come up with some kind of an explanation as to how they were going to get around this challenge. So there was a Russian scientist still alive by the name of Oparin, O-P-A-R-I-N. And Oparin said that the original atmosphere of the Earth didn't contain any oxygen, and that by the forces of nature, including lightning, which gave a force, this is how the original life came to this planet. And he recommended that somebody should start working in a lab to duplicate what he conceived to be the original atmosphere and to organize an experiment which would produce life, because this is what the objective is. Well, they kept mucking around from 1938, when Oparin first broached this idea. Then the war came along and they were on other things. After the war, they started to work on it again. And in the early 50s, a man by the name of Miller conducted an experiment, which I'm now going to show you, which he announced to the world that he had created life. And on your paper there, I have a small, it's kind of hard to see, but this is a little bigger, and you can see the experiment. Now remember, what he's going to do is he's going to create life out of this experiment, because if it happened in the past by chance, we should be able to do it in the laboratory now. Great. So Miller had this experiment, and I'll just go over quickly what he had. First of all, he has a closed system here. This is boiling water. This is a pump which evacuates everything out of the system so that they have a clean system inside so they can put in what they want. So what they put into the system, having evacuated the air that we have here, they put in hydrogen, water vapor, methane, and ammonia. Then they put in two electrodes, which go like that, and when you put an electric spark through the electrodes, it arcs across that little gap there, causing a spark. And the spark is a force, which of course has the ability to do certain things to chemicals. Then they have a condenser here. They have cold water going in and going out here, so that when these gases condense, or they're hot, you see, by the action of the electrodes, and this cools them off, and then whatever is dropped out of this experiment comes down here and is trapped into a trap below, and then after a while you can analyze what's in the trap and see what you've got. Now, remember that what they're duplicating is the original atmosphere. So they said the original atmosphere, you'll see it had no oxygen, whereas this atmosphere has a lot of oxygen. And I'll tell you the reason why they had to come up with no oxygen in the first place. This arc that is here is, in nature, would be lightning. So this atmosphere is out there, you see, when the Earth cooled down, and lightning is what the force that was applied to get the first life system going. So now they duplicated lightning, and so they rigged up this experiment, and Miller did, and of course for it he got the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. Now to show you, I haven't finished with this yet, to show you how the scientific world con everybody, about 2 years ago, maybe it's three, there was an announcement in the paper that at the University of Guelph, which is 30 miles north of Hamilton, one of the professors of microbiology was going to put on a lecture, and the title of it was From Amoeba to Man. Now the amoeba is the smallest living cell that we know about. I say we, I'm not a scientist, they know about it. So he was going to put this lecture on From Amoeba to Man. So I said to my wife, we got to go and see this thing. So we went up to Guelph, was on at 7:30 at night. There was an auditorium twice this size, it hold 1,000 people. It was one of these auditoriums that was sloped, much more than this is, in a kind of a, like a football field around. Down at the front, like this, this experiment right here, this Miller-Urey experiment is called, was set up on a table. Well, the lights were all on, everybody came in, and the place was packed. We got there early, I'm happy to say, so we got a seat way up near the roof, because by the time even we got there, the place was just about full, and hundreds were turned away, because this is University of Guelph, and this was a big thing. So at 7:30, when the thing was going to start, the lights were put out. It was as black as coal in there. You couldn't see anything. It was absolutely pitch black dark. Suddenly, everybody is aware that something's going to happen, because they could see a guy sort of in the darkness down here. And suddenly, there's a flash when they arc this thing across. There's an intense, like a guy welding, intense flash of light, and it illuminated the whole room. Suddenly the lights went on, and a professor walked in, and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, we have just created life in a test tube." Well, the people, you know, I looked around, they were absolutely thunderstruck and dumbfounded. You'd think that here was a new Messiah had walked in. Well, first of all, that statement that professor made was a downright barefaced lie. Now let me tell you something. He created, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, the equivalent of this. Supposing you had a 52-story skyscraper, with plumbing and electrical and air conditioning systems and telephone systems and microcomputers, the whole thing full of the most modern equipment you ever saw in your life in the thing to make the whole skyscraper, the office building, work. You know what he created? He created the equivalent of 15 bricks around the first layer of to build the skyscraper. Never mind anything electrical inside or the plumbing system or the telephone system or anything else. So he created the equivalent of 15 bricks, which isn't much, you know, toward a construction of a skyscraper. And he told the people that he had made a skyscraper, complete with all this interior gear. Now that ain't a lie. I don't know what is. Now what happened? Well, they had these four elements here. They put the ark across, and sure enough, out dropped amino acids. Now amino acids, now remember, I'm not a microbiologist, but I've done a lot of reading on this, and I don't think you have to be a PhD from Harvard to read. And in this trap came out five amino acids. Now living systems require 20 amino acids to function. They were able to spill out five. And even to this day, although they've been trying like mad, they still haven't got the whole 20 manufactured. They've got, I think, up to about 18 now, but there's two they still haven't been able to manufacture synthetically. Now, far from creating life, they did succeed in creating some amino acids, which are what they call the building blocks of living systems. They did do that. But that's a very far cry. It's just as far a cry from building a living system as it is 5 or 15 bricks on a skyscraper and calling it a skyscraper. There's other things that are wrong with this. In fact, one of the members of the Creation Research Institute in California named Dr. Gish has written quite an extensive critique of this theory, and he's given about 20 reasons why this couldn't happen in the original Earth. Well, the first thing is that most scientists now are agreed that there was oxygen in the original atmosphere. And if there was, then oxygen combines with the amino acids and immediately destroys them. That's why they had to have a reducing atmosphere to start with. But the other fatal flaw, of course, in the whole scheme, as far as trying to prove that this is how life came to this planet, is that there's no trap in the primordial oceans. And the very next time that lightning hit, it would destroy the stuff it already made. You see, if they left the amino acids up in here and arced the thing again, the original acids they had would be immediately destroyed. So they had to get them down in a trap. Well, there's no trap in the original primordial ocean that they talked about. They didn't have a trap out there to trap out this stuff that was supposed to be dropped from the lightning shot. So the next time lightning hit, of course, they'd all be destroyed. And if there was any oxygen present, which most of the scientists now agree there was, of course, they'd be destroyed too. So while this experiment it wasn't bad. The guy should get 98%, I guess, he did get a Nobel Prize for conducting it. Still, it's a very far cry from creating life. Now, there's another thing about this that I think I want to mention before I go on. Again, I'm not a microbiologist by any means, but there's a very interesting thing about those amino acids that were dropped out, and that is this. Every amino acid always comes in two forms, and they are like your hands. They're mirror images one of another. They have exactly the same chemical constitution. So here we've got them here. They've got this constitution is exactly the same. This one in the center is exactly the same. This one, however, is a mirror image of that. This should be H2N, not NH2. So they're exactly the same chemical constitution, but they're physically different, just like your two hands have the same chemical constitution, but they're physically different. The one is a mirror image of the other. Now, brothers and sisters, it just so happens that in all living systems, the only one that can be used is the left-hand one. Nature never uses the right-hand one. Never. In that trap that we just looked at here, there are always equal amounts of left-hand and right-hand amino acids dropped out. But when nature comes to make up a living system, it has a discriminator within it which can discriminate between the left hand and the right hand, and it always uses the left hand. Now, this has been a bit of a teaser for evolutionists, and I want to read you what one of the most famous evolutionists has to say on this point. Now, this is a book called Time's Arrow and Evolution, written by Harold F. Plum, who is professor at Princeton University, a world-renowned evolutionist, and this book has gone through several editions. Now, here's what he has to say about this point. As a matter of fact, if any of you students want to get into this, and I heartily urge you that you do, you can't get a better book than this, because his chapter 10 is called The Origin of Life, and he gives about 15 reasons why it couldn't happen. Even though he's an evolutionist, and the book is issued to prove that evolution did happen, he has a chapter here called The Origin of Life, which he gives 15 reasons why it could never happen. And this is one of them. And this is what he says. Let us briefly consider another intriguing problem with regard to the origin of the proteins, or rather, the origin of their building blocks, the amino acids. All the amino acids derivable from proteins are of the left-handed variety. Amino acids synthesized in the laboratory are a mixture of right and left-handed forms. And thermodynamically, the two are indistinguishable. In other words, they're exactly the same as far as use goes. Yet, the living organism uses only one kind in building proteins. Now, brothers and sisters, I believe that this is a divine refutation of the theory of evolution, as if there weren't 10,000 more. But I believe that the fact that these acids are produced in equal amounts in nature, and that the living system has a discriminator within it to use only the left hand, is a providential indication that intelligence is necessary to produce life. He asked the question, why should only left-handed amino acids be utilizable? Why should they, he says. We have no very good answer to this question. This guy is a professor at Princeton University. He's a high priest, in fact, a cardinal of the theory of evolution. And he says, we haven't got any answer to this question. Well, I want to now come to another fatal flaw in the theory of evolution. I didn't really intend to spend a lot of time on this. What time is it? I'll just briefly go over this. You know, they talk about a simple cell. Well, that again is a barefaced, downright lie. There's no cell on earth that even could remotely be called simple. In fact, even evolutionists are constantly commenting on what they call the unbelievable complexity of a simple, what they call a simple cell. Now, I'm not a microbiologist, but I'm not going to take the time, I don't think, this morning to go into the tremendous and unbelievable complexity of even a simple cell. But we might just make a note or two that there are about, there's 11 here of items within the cell that are essential for its operation. And there's manufacturing plants, there's a mini computer in there, there's the epidermis has three layers, all of which perform specific functions. The thing has to respire, that is breathe, it has to eliminate, it has to digest, it has to do all the functions of a living system perfectly the first time. Now, if you can believe, give you another thought on this subject. This is a picture, and this appeared in the December issue of Scientific American of 1983, just 6 months ago. They built a thing like this that weighs 22 tons out in Boulder, which is in Colorado, isn't it? Yeah, Boulder, Colorado, okay. This thing is a tremendously powerful microscope. It will, when you get the thing going, it'll look down and blow up anything you look at. Are you listening? 300,000 times. In other words, a tiny speck, you can blow the thing up so it's 300,000 times. So they just got this thing going just in the last little while, and they took a look at the interior of one of these simple cells. Darwin said that in the first instance there was a simple cell, and then the cell divided and became two, and then it was four, and finally it got up to man, you know, from amoeba to man. So now for the first time, scientists have been able to take a look at a simple cell. And you want to show what the interior of a simple cell, just one, you know, I can't even tell you how small a particle we're looking at, but here is what just a very small portion of a simple cell looks like. Look at the intricate system that this isn't a cell, this is a microscopic portion of a cell. But when you blow it up 300,000 times, just look at the lattice work and the marvel of complexity that makes that cell operate. Now, if you can believe that that all came about by chance, believe you me, you've got some belief. But there's more to it even than that. I better skip what I was going to do there and go to what I want to do now. Now listen to me carefully, because I have here an instrument that, and you're going to think I'm crazy for a minute, because if you don't listen carefully, and if I'm not smart enough to explain what I'm trying to get across, nobody here will know what reason I have for doing what I'm doing. There was a guy in the last century by the name of Morse, and he conceived the idea that he could send messages over wires. This was before the invention of the telephone. So how was he going to do it? They didn't know how to send voice over the thing, but they did know how to send sound, but not to the extent of the human voice at this point of time. This was about 1830 or something like that. But he did say that he could send sound. So he conceived the brilliant idea of codifying sound into what he called dots and dashes. So there's a dot and there's a dash. So he conceived the idea that if he could work out a scheme whereby he could send these dots and dashes through the wires, the guy at the other end could pick them up and a message could be transferred even across the Atlantic Ocean. And that's what they did when they put the first transatlantic cable from the United States over to Europe. So he said, well, we got to get a system. So if we have, it's kind of hard because in order, just a minute. Can you hear that at the back without this up here? Okay. All right, now let's get this thing going. So here's the, can you see that letter A? Okay, so that's a dot and a dash. That's A. B, dash. You with me? What's the next one? That's C, D. Okay? All right. So this international Morse code was developed, and ships at sea and all sorts of businesses started using this Morse code. Now, I want you to tell me what I'm now going to do. And in order to, so you don't have to look at this whole thing, I'm going to make it easy for you. And I'm going to be talking about something in this area right here. Okay, so I'm going to send out three letters. Okay, now here we go. What's that? Okay, terrific. Now what's this? Oh, what's this? All right, now what's this mean? What's that mean? Is that okay so far? All right, now what does that mean though with the guy at the other end and the other ship? Here's what it means. All right. Who says it means that? Who? Everybody here says it means peril. How do you know it means peril? How do you know it doesn't mean star or love or peace or whatever? How do you know it means peril? Now think about this for a minute. How do you know it means peril? How does anybody know it means peril? When a receiver on a, there's two ships going across the Atlantic. One's going one way and one the other. The guy on the keyboard of one ship gets this message over the air or over his receiver, SOS, and the Carpathia, we're at longitude 42 north and something or other south. How does he know that means peril? Right, it's an established insignia. In other words, some outside intelligence has decided that SOS means peril, right? Now let me ask you this. Is peril intrinsic within that diagram? Would you know anything about peril by looking at the diagram? No, you wouldn't. You have to have an outside agency, an outside intelligence, tell you or inform you that peril is intrinsic when you have that particular combination of symbols put together. Now, has everybody got that point? Okay. Now, I got so many, I'm like Brother Finley, I have so many diagrams here, I can't find what I want. I'll find it, just a minute. Yeah, I did, there it is. All right. Now, here's what Huxley, who was Darwin's bulldog, said about chance. He said, if you have a monkey going like this on a typewriter long enough, he will by chance type out one of Shakespeare's plays. You're all laughing, but this is the theory that these scientists go by. That the unbelievable impossibility that chance happened makes it happen. So they say that it would be very unusual for life to start by this chance process. But the very unusual part of it is proof that it did happen. All right, now, What I'm now trying to do, and I have about 5 minutes to do it, is to link up this crazy experiment here that I just tried to do with what scientists are saying. So you have to follow me a little bit closely. Let's say that they did drop out a living system down here, that somehow or other they were able to, they'll never do it. Believe me, they'll never do it. But let's say that they did. They had some high-class experiment with all kinds of tubes and electrodes and gases and radiation and goodness knows what, and somehow or other they dropped the thing out, and out came a living cell. Now remember, they'll never do it. They aren't even within 10,000 times 10,000 miles of doing it. Although they've spent billions of dollars, all this space program only has one real purpose, that's to find life out there. Because then if they find life, then they can say, we told you so, life can happen not only on the Earth, but it can happen on Mars or someplace. First, they never found it, and they spent all your money doing it, and they're going to continue spending your money doing it. But this was really the end result of all that space program. All right, so with this elaborate experiment, they drop out a living cell. And they announce to the world a guy gets a Nobel Prize and everything, and now they have a living cell. All right, so now they say, well, now we have the first cell. Now remember, they haven't got it. I'm just assuming that we give them that page in the book. Now, when you and I were born, there was two cells came together. Now this, everybody have a look at the human body for a minute. Look at yourself. You got fingernails, which are one type of product. You got skin, which is another. If you went in there, you have blood, which is another. You have bone, which is another. You have cartilage, you have muscle. Then you come up here, you have hair, which is a totally different kind of a substance from any of these. You've got eye cells, which are completely different again. The enamel of the teeth is different. The tongue is from a different, the liver, everything is different, all inside. Now, somewhere in those two cells which came together to form you was information which told the cells what to do to make the cartilage and the bone and the blood and the hair and the enamel and so forth. Now, even if you were able to drop out a living cell out of some experiment of this type, where does the information come from? Who is it that says that SOS means peril? Who is it that says to the cell, we want you to make a cartilage out of this group of divisions, we want blood for this, we want hair for this, we want tooth enamel for this, we want kidney structure for this, we want sex organs and all this stuff. Where's the outside intelligence that tells this cell that they made what to do? Now there is the root disease of evolution. Well, I don't know whether I'm smart enough this morning to get this across to you or not, but if you want to read really a treatise on the subject, then you young people should go to the bookstore and get this book, which is called The Natural Sciences Know Nothing of Evolution by Dr. A.E. Wilder Smith. Because this is a treatise on this very subject. And what I've tried to do is make a thing which is much more complex than I'm either capable or able to do in this class intelligible to you. But when we look at what we have down here on page 2, we say at the foot of that diagram, there is a fatal flaw in the theory of evolution, and we say, what gives meaning or logos? See, logos is mind and intelligence. What gives intelligence? What gives the intelligent information to the cell to direct it to do all these marvelous things which make up and constitute the marvel of our body? Whence arose the unbelievably complex information system? Now, how many here work on computers? Come on, everybody that I ever saw is graduating in computer science. How many here are knowledgeable about computers. Yeah, well, there's quite a few Well, as you know, computers consist of hardware and software. And you might have a good hardware machine, but if the software doesn't go in properly, of course, you don't get a very good result. Well, the software, they both require intelligence, but the software, the stuff going into the computer, of course, requires intelligence so that the stuff that the computer spits out at the other end is intelligible. There's outside intelligence. There's nothing intrinsic in the computer that does anything. The whole thing is generated by outside intelligence. Now, there's nothing intrinsic in a cell that scientists might be able to make unless outside intelligence is applied to direct the cell to tell it what to do, to compute and to spit out the information at the other end. The end information being the construction of a human body or the animal body or the orchid or whatever it is that is under construction. Now, that's only scratching the surface of what's wrong with the theory of evolution. What I'm pleading for is that our young people read up on what's wrong with the theory of evolution and not be conned into what they're taught at school. You've got to almost have a campaign going with young people to counteract the garbage that are being taught in the schools and in the colleges. You send your kid to college and they brainwash them on this theory of evolution. And of course the peer pressure is on, and unless the student has a pretty good handle on what's going on, of course he will be snowed under and become an atheist, because that's the whole purpose of the thing, to un-God the universe. Now tomorrow we want to spend a little time on the Christadelphian worldview. In other words, are we right in saying that we have the true worldview? Well, it just so happens, brothers and sisters and young people, that we are. So we'll have a crack at that tomorrow.